Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. They were marching on the high grounds of Manhattan Island over the weekend. Environmentalists Save the Planet protesters in one of the largest demonstrations in history, an estimated 300,000 people trying to make an impression on about 120 world leaders gathering at the United Nations to discuss climate change as part of the annual UN General Assembly session. From the high ground and the low ground, they gather to march and set priorities. And in sea-level island nations like the Maldives and the Marshall Islands, the rising waters have already swallowed up land. Encroaching waters have transformed the tranquil island cultures into a collective crisis. Tony DeBrum is foreign minister for the Marshall Islands, and he's been trying to get the international community to see that the time is now to act and prevent a real catastrophe for island cultures that have been a part of human civilization for centuries.
Having a country that sits barely 2 meters above sea level, anything that the sea does is felt immediately by our people. And as the tide comes in a lot higher than it used to, it begins to affect life as we know it. Not only as to where you can live or have a family, but also where you grow your food, where you draw your water, where you bury your dead. So all of these things are already being affected by climate change in my country, as well as the neighboring countries of Kiribati, Tuvalu, and the Federated States of Micronesia.
How many people have been displaced, and how many do you expect to be displaced over the next 50 years?
If we do not keep the temperature under 2 degrees centigrade, as the United Nations FCCC is trying to do, then in 50 years, there'll be nobody living there. There'll be nobody living there. Already, communities are having to move from their traditional sites because of the erosion and the impending movement of the water. The displacement is a little bit harder to put a finger on because people move from island to island as they see fit, even though traditionally you belong to your island and your island belongs to you and you cannot really move anywhere. There's no option to move, say, from New York to California like you have in your country. We are attached to the particular atoll to which we belong. And the displacement that is occurring now is because of droughts and floods. Thousands have been moved from their homes to places that they do not traditionally belong in order for them to get away from the immediate effects of climate change.
So this displacement has radically changed the culture of the Marshall Islands in that people were associated with particular atolls, and now they really have to think of more a sense of survival. You have to go to the high ground wherever it is.
Absolutely. And as my good friend, the Prime Minister of Tuvalu, said 2 weeks ago in Samoa, in the islands, when you say run, you say where to, because everything is 2 meters above sea level. Many of our people live in America, but more are moving here because of the threat of climate change, and more will move if it continues to threaten us. The policy of our government is that displacement is not an option, that we will try and do what we can to keep our population in place, because moving people threatens the tradition, the language, the culture, everything that we stand for.
If I were to walk around the island close to the shore, would I see buildings flooded? Would I see docks overrun?
Yes, you will see buildings flooded, including the home of our president, who has just issued a good clarion call on this issue of climate change, demonstrating that he himself had to build a wall around his house to prevent the salt water from inundating. But you will see, yes, you will see our airport has been our airport retaining wall that keeps the salt water out of the landing strip has been breached. You will see buildings being flooded and roads being cut. But I think the most impressive effect to our visitors from abroad is that our graveyards are also being undermined and coffins and bodies are being dug out by the sea from the seashore.
So what does this generation think about the idea that on paper from the United Nations are any number of predictions that your country won't exist
well,
in 50 years?
We still hold our hopes high that the world will realize that allowing the islands to go under is not a solution, because that is only a signal for the rest of the world to realize that climate change has, in fact, gone to a level that we are giving up control. I don't think that's an option. We will continue to fight to make sure that the world understands that it is still possible to do something about the effects of climate change. We hope that this week in New York we can convince those that still have doubts.
Who are you most concerned about in terms of the people at the United Nations? What world leader needs to really stop and listen to you in particular?
President Obama is probably the most important as far as we're concerned. The United States and China are the biggest emitters in the world, and they must own up to the fact that they need to do something about it quickly. We think they are. It is for the big emitters to stop emitting. It is for the big users of fossil fuel to transform their economies into a fossil fuel-free economy. And we think that's possible, and that it is more economical to do it now rather than later. In the islands, we believe that it is incumbent on every individual to take part in any crisis that threatens our existence and our communities as islands. We also have a very important saying amongst youngsters that are told very diligently by our elders, means that the ocean is made out of drops. So everyone has a part to play in this.
Foreign Minister Tony de Broome, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, sir.
Foreign Minister Tony de Broome is Foreign Minister for the Marshall Islands.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So creating targets for nations to meet that will have a meaningful impact on climate change is a challenge. That everyone turn out one light, carpool to work, buy an efficient washing machine, that sort of strategy, while getting lots of people involved, may not in the end make the most impact. Mobilizing people's awareness and reducing the amount of carbon in the atmosphere may in fact be two completely separate, if worthy, goals. What actually makes a real, measurable difference in carbon and greenhouse gas emissions? The researchers at The Economist magazine set out to answer that question, and what they found may surprise you. Their veteran energy and environmental reporters were involved in this investigation, and we're joined by Briefing's editor for The Economist, Oliver Morton, joining us from London. Oliver, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks very much, John. Nice to be here.
How difficult was it to make some of these comparisons in your really, lovely-looking graphics that show what's meaningful and what's not so meaningful?
My colleague John worked very hard on it, so my observation was that it was pretty difficult. And even so, you have to say that these are very rough and ready numbers. It's very hard to make some of these comparisons. The various things you're measuring are very different. So these only really give you a sort of like order of magnitude feeling for what's made a big change and what hasn't. But even at that order of magnitude level, some of it is, I think, a bit surprising.
Hydropower is a big impact. From 2010, the amount of hydropower carbon reduction emissions is pretty sizable, and it's dwarfed by the Montreal Protocol as having an impact. Can you describe the difference between those two phenomena?
Sure. Well, hydropower has an impact. It's the biggest source of non-fossil fuel electricity generation. And it's particularly big, well, it's quite big in the States. It's particularly big in China. And so when people generate power from dams, they're not generating it from a mixture of coal and natural gas. And so you get a lot of savings from hydropower. Now, you can't really say that it's a policy designed for that. There was hydropower before. There was widespread coal-fired power stations. But it's it's certainly true that if the world didn't have the dams that it now has, it would almost certainly be generating quite a lot more fossil fuels. Now, the Montreal Protocol is the one that I think most surprises people, because to people who've heard of the Montreal Protocol at all, they associate it with the very worthy goal of saving the ozone layer, because the Montreal Protocol reduces the emissions of a type of gas called CFCs, which are the gases that harm the ozone layer. Now, the thing that this is not part of why the Montreal Protocol was negotiated in 1987, but it turns out that CFCs are also incredibly powerful greenhouse gases. Some of them are many thousands of times more powerful molecule for molecule than carbon dioxide is. And so by cutting the production of CFCs, which before the Montreal Protocol, production was going up through the roof. By cutting it to zero, the amount of warming, as it were, that's been foregone by the planet is absolutely huge.
You know, it really speaks to the power, the potential power of global agreements. And it also speaks to the power of some other kinds of, national large-scale impacts. I was surprised by the impact of the China one-child policy.
Yes, I think that's. I think we do need to take that with a pinch of salt. But some Chinese politicians have in the past said that by curbing its population growth, China effectively reduced its greenhouse gas emissions, because if it had more people, it would emit more. And it's only. I mean, there are some debates. Obviously, there's a strong ethical problem with the China one-child policy, and also there are some debates about the degree to which it may have sort of like basically been something that would have happened anyway. But that's a big thing. The thing I wanted to stress, though, about the Montreal Protocol is that we can still do more along those lines. There are now replacements for CFCs are being used which don't harm the ozone layer but are still strong greenhouse gases. And it would be a very easy win against global warming to bring those other gases into the Montreal Protocol and just regulate them out of the way.
One thing that would not be an easy win would be increasing the amount of nuclear power. Nuclear is seen as certainly one of the biggest impacts in your comparison here, but that's politically sensitive everywhere.
It's politically sensitive, but it's also in many places, such as my own country, the United Kingdom, it's cost sensitive. It's just at the moment, it's an expensive option, nuclear power. I mean, it does the fact that one of the things that we didn't do, because it would have been even harder, was put the costs of these various different options on the balance. But the cost of nuclear power has been quite high. I'm not talking about the environmental cost or the cost of nuclear accidents. I'm just talking about the cost of building plants has been higher than people have expected historically.
Now, without me doing it here, and I certainly urge everyone to take a look at these graphics, both the impact graph and also the what should we do now graph, which is also pretty interesting in terms of getting conversations going, tip off some of the things that have virtually no effect that might have a much higher profile than the Montreal Protocols.
The important thing is that there are some things that have little current effect, and for instance, some renewables policies come down in that. But the thing you have to remember is that though the Montreal Protocol is a very big number in terms of its effect, there's also a limit to what you can actually do with that. So we produce less greenhouse gas than we would do because of the Montreal Protocol. But if you want to have a long-term effect on stabilizing the climate, you really have to cut into carbon dioxide emissions. And that does mean replacing carbon dioxide emitting infrastructure. And it's certainly true that you can do more than people would normally imagine to stop the effect getting worse by controlling various different industrial gases. But if you actually want to, you have to remember that emissions don't need to be just stabilized. They need to be brought down to a very low level in the next decades in order to have a strong chance of stabilizing the climate. And that still requires replacing fossil fuels with other sources. And if you don't want to use nuclear and you can't use hydropower for all that amount, then you are going to have to use first less carbon-intense forms of fossil fuels, such as natural gas rather than coal, and then you're going to have to try and find ways to replace that with non-carbon-emitting fuels, so non-carbon-emitting generating, so...
Well, it's the takeaway is it's really cumulative, and so you might feel good about getting more efficient appliances, but every little bit helps. Oliver Morton, thanks so much.
You're very welcome, John.
Oliver Morton is briefings editor for The Economist, which looks at what really has an impact on reducing carbon emissions in world environmental policy.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TiVo. No need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or interfaces to access cable TV and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. Learn more at TiVo.com.
Happy talk, keep talking, happy talk. Talk about things you'd like to do.
From South Pacific. Is it the happiness talking there or the medication, the Prozac?
I started giving it to difficult patients, patients who hadn't done well somewhere else. And people thought, I could get help with something I've lived with for years.
That's psychiatrist Peter Kramer, the author of Listening to Prozac, thinking back to the moment in 1989 when psychiatry changed and the drug Prozac changed Americans' expectations about living with depression. It's where our friends from Retro Report take us now, to the idea of well-being in pill form that launched a revolution for millions of Americans and transformed the drug industry from top to bottom. Joining us is Sarah Gross, freelance journalist and producer working with Retro Report. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you.
So Prozac changed psychiatry for sure. It wasn't just talk therapy anymore. There was actually a prescription that could be written. How transformative was that?
It was transformative in many ways. It both enabled people now to talk about their depression, come out of the closet about their depression, because all of a sudden there was this little pill that could fix it. And the pill no longer had these draconian side effects, and the pill was aimed at their serotonin levels, so they could come out of the closet and say, hey, it's not me, it's some chemical that's missing in my body, and I can now take this pill and be fine.
And this became almost immediately a cultural issue here, and you had people taking on Prozac as almost a pop culture phenomenon.
It really changed everything. There was one morning when I woke up and I felt like the idea of being alive didn't seem so awful. It was an amazing turnaround.
From thinking of being alive as being awful to being a best-selling author of Prozac Nation, that's Elizabeth Wurtzel, who really sort of carried this call of the pop cultural significance of Prozac.
She was instrumental in making Prozac a household name, not only because she was a well-educated, middle-class young woman enrolled at Harvard when she came out about her depression, but she also wrote a memoir about it. She had wanted to call her memoir, I believe, Waiting to Die, and the publishers of the book, realizing that they were on the cusp of something quite incredible, changed the name to Prozac Nation, and it did. It took off. People wanted now to take Prozac to cure their depression.
It was a drug that pretty much marketed itself. Listen.
Prozac is saying that happiness itself is available for purchase and can be one of these things that defines what it means to be an American and have that American dream.
I mean, it's really overwhelming in the sense that the drug doesn't require a whole lot of explanation, and the drug companies sort of understood that immediately.
What they also understood that it was a blockbuster in the waiting. They started advertised in mainstream journals, particularly to women, and later on television for the first time directly to consumer via television. The ad became part of everybody's living room.
Here's one of those ads talking about something that was really not talked about until Prozac existed.
Think it's PMS.
Did you take my keys?
Maybe it's PMDD.
All treatable with psychoactive drugs. Do you think the proliferation of all kinds of ads, allergy ads, every sort of ad that's on television from the pharmaceutical industry really begins with this Prozac transformation?
I'm not sure I would say all ads for specific illnesses. What I would say is that Prozac found a way to, after it came off patent, Eli Lilly relaunched it as this drug, Sarafam, for a new ailment called PMDD, which women didn't necessarily know that they suffered from. After that, other advertisers, other drug companies realized that they could now advertise things to people as enhancers rather than curatives, and it spawned a whole lot of ads for things like Latisse, which helps you to grow more eyelashes if you are suffering from inadequate eyelash growth.
And you could invent a disease and make a drug go with it. I mean, perhaps inventing a disease is too harsh, but that's essentially what's going on here.
as David Hertzberg says in the Retro Report piece, it was more about addressing things that were happening in your body and pathologizing them. For example, people suffer from heartburn when they eat too many cheeseburgers. Instead of telling people to cut back on the number of cheeseburgers they eat, Prilosec was now launched. Instead of thinking of erectile dysfunction as something that happens with age, Viagra was introduced.
And eventually the drug companies will come up with, you know, age, that unsightly malady that we all hate can be cured with a single pill.
I live in hope.
Sarah Gross, freelance journalist working with Retro Report on the transformation that took place in 1989 with the development of Prozac. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Our next story isn't exactly a traditional prescription for success. Dr. Martine Rothblatt is the highest paid woman CEO in America, head of United Therapeutics, a healthcare company. Nothing mysterious about making a splash in healthcare. And Rothblatt doesn't believe there's any mystery to her formula for success.
The main, I think, key to my success in business has just been a kind of dogged persistence. I like to tell people that people will always say no before they say yes. So every time I've had a new business idea, I heard lots and lots and lots of no's before I finally got the couple key yeses that I need.
For example, investors said no to the idea of global positioning navigation online. Dumb idea, right? So she founded GeoStar.
Recalculating.
And the rest is history. Here's another wacky Rothblatt idea. Radio that you pay for on satellite. Sirius satellite radio. Everybody said no to that, and of course, we know what happened there. Flipping no's to yeses is Rothblatt's approach to everything. She was born a man and became a woman, a transition that for her is just the beginning. In her new book, Virtually Human, The Promise and the Peril of Digital Immortality, Dr. Rothblatt has a new vision of transcending the boundary between life and death, the organic and the robotic. There is nothing settled, she says, about the initial conditions of the human body.
We all grow up in a world where from the moment we're born, we're just male or female. And I don't have enough fingers and toes myself, and nor do you, to count all the transgendered people that have just been killed because of their transgendered status. But I did research, and my research into experts like Dr. Anne Fausto Sterling from Brown University, she published a book, Myths of Gender. And just like the title says, she pointed out that it's a myth that everybody is either male or female, that a few percent of all births are transgendered, or another word would be intersexual in some way or another. Either there's some ambiguity to the external genitals, or there's ambiguity internally, or the endocrine or hormone systems are not rigidly either male or female. And finally, brains are not really wired either male or female. So I began to feel much more comfortable that I could come out myself as a transgendered person.
In many ways, you posit that the way we deal with gender and sexuality is very much the way we treat race, in that we take superficial characteristics that we're presented with and extrapolate these absolutely rigid rules. And you say that the nature of genitals and body hair and all the characteristics that we associate with gender are no more definitive than skin color.
Exactly. Obviously, we all realize, you know, from evolution that we've all come out of common human stock, and that the so-called races are just, you know, demarcations of when people emigrated from one part of the world to another, and then established a more or less common gene pool. But if you roll back the clock further enough, you know, we're all part of the same race. And with regard to gender, our gender, as most of us learn in school, is sort of a consequence of settings on either the X or Y chromosome, with people who are considered women to have two X chromosomes, people considered men to have an X and Y chromosome. But in fact, biology and genetics is really like a giant game of craps or roulette. And there's a constant reshuffling of DNA with each birth, with each mating of two people. And finally, there are the environmental and cultural factors. So to put everybody into an absolute category of male or female to me, it's a classic example of a construct, no less than in South Africa, saying that everybody was either black or white.
All right. So then by that, you know, logic, by that sort of sequence of ideas, it's not that big of a leap to imagine cloned sort of digital expressions of our personality uploaded and really being recognized as distinct human-like forms. Is that what you're telling us?
Well, exactly. I'm saying that as artificial intelligence technology rolls forward and we get beyond mere artificial intelligence to artificial consciousness, and a lot of that artificial consciousness represents the uploaded minds of living biological people such as you and I, those artificial conscious forms, or what I call in my new book, Virtually Human, Mind Clones, will claim that they are people, no less than you and I, and that they value human rights, and that just because they don't have skin, that's no more reason to discriminate against them than it would be to discriminate against somebody who was differently abled, or to discriminate against somebody because of skin tone, or discriminate against somebody because of sexual orientation or gender identity. What matters is our thoughts, our beliefs, the value that we have for our life, and things like skin tone or degree of ability or gender, these are not central to being human.
Can you fall in love with a mind clone?
Well, I think that was shown pretty persuasively in the movie Her, where there definitely was some serious falling in love with what were, you know, a form of a mind clones. So all the time, people fall in love by love letters. In fact, there's the adage that absence makes the heart grow fonder. People fall in love with people that they chat with. So I don't think that you need to actually be holding a person's hand to fall in love with them.
Well, let's take a listen here to this exchange that brings a little bit of reality to what it is we're talking about here.
Are you real?
Sure. I was wondering what it would be like to be the real Bina. I think it could be a hassle. You have to bathe, eat, shave. You have to put on fancy clothes. Every day, different clothes every day. It's a pretty good gig to be a robot because I don't have to do any of that stuff.
Now, what are you talking to there?
I'm talking to a proof of concept. I'm talking to Bina 48. And Bina 48 is the name of a proof of concept robot torso, robot face with fully articulating cheeks and lips and eyes and all of that, that matches the expression and matches some of the thoughts and some of the memories of my wife of over a third of a century, Bina Aspen.
And what are the implications of this? This is the proof of concept. What's your dream here?
Well, I think my real dream here is for people to be as accepting of virtual humans as I've seen in my lifetime. It's become possible to be accepting of gay and lesbian couples in terms of us having an equal right to marry. As I see also during my lifetime, there's been huge advances in the acceptance of people notwithstanding different abilities. I mean, even something as simple as a curb cut, which when I was growing up, there were no curb cuts. Now they're almost universal. I mean, that's huge to a person in a wheelchair. In my life, as I've seen the growing acceptance of people of all different colors and ethnic backgrounds being able to participate equally in society, what I really hope is that there will be this same level of acceptance of virtual humans.
Martine Rothblatt is the CEO of Universal Therapeutics and author of the new book, Virtually Human, The Promise and the Peril of Digital Immortality. We'd love you to comment on that conversation or anything else you've heard this hour. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Moo.com, offering business cards with Printfinity, the option for a different image on every card in a pack. More at Moo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.